This is URN,
the Film Show Breakdown.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Film Show. We are of course still recording from home as we are technically still in isolation, as everyone should be. Stay home, stay safe, and all that. That's my part done. We are, of course, here to talk about two films which are available on streaming, because of course, our main film could not be released in cinema for the very reasons we were just discussing. I believe it was intended to, at least that's what I read somewhere, but it does feel it is a Netflix-produced film, so...
Bought it just as it was like confirming that it couldn't be released in cinema. So
oh, is that why it was bought to be distributed by Netflix?
After it couldn't be distributed cinematically.
That makes sense. It all adds up. It all adds up in the end. Obviously sponsored by Lyft as well. paid for by Lyft. I even got the message at the start of the film contains product placement. I was like, don't worry. I know. I'm aware. Which is weird, because Kumail Nanjiani has appeared in three films now in which... ride-sharing services are clearly a big sponsor.
The ride-sharing trilogy.
Starting with our second film, which we're going to talk about, The Big Sick, which was very obviously sponsored by Uber. Then he did Stuber, where he actually where he played an Uber driver again, that I haven't seen. And honestly... Yeah, but
the thing is, though, it makes no sense that he's an Uber driver in The Big Sick, because it's set in 2007, you know.
It's based on the story from 2007, but I think it's supposed to be updated to nowish.
Yeah, if that makes sense.
The thing about Stuber is, I know that's not what we're talking about, but I was thinking about it earlier, so I just wanted to bring it up. It feels like, it looks like one of them films which is like a write-off. Like, it's just, it's... It's like the actors are just contracted to do one more film with the studio, and they're reusing assets, and they barely promote it. It's really bizarre.
I'm proud of it, yeah.
I don't remember.
It's out of Adam Sandler's Netflix film.
It looks like a fake movie. It looks like something from like the Tropic Thunder trailers or like Funny People, you know?
It's got like Dave Bautista as he was getting more and more popular, and the same with Kumail Nanjiani. So it's got two reasonably bankable stars, but it doesn't feel like a film that anyone actually cared about.
I love that we're just trying not to review the film you guys are going to review.
Oh no, I'm setting the stage for his better films in the car share trilogy.
No, bring him down before you bring him up.
Exactly, because our first film was released six days ago.
It was last Friday.
Last Friday, we are very on point today with our recent release, as of course we're having to adapt.
This is the first recent release we've done in like 3 months.
The introduction just ties together perfectly there
none of you want to watch The Assistant and be depressed and all, you know.
I haven't even seen a trailer for the Assistant.
Oh no, it's on. There's trailers. They've been around for a little while. Yeah, that's maybe my favorite film that's been released this year.
Who has seen Lovebirds?
I have,
unfortunately.
So you haven't? Oh, well, you have, Ben. We were just... That's why you said... Yeah, okay. Isaac, have you?
Nah.
Unbelievable. But you have seen The Big Sick?
Yes.
The other Michael Showalter, Kumail Nanjiani collaboration?
Well, he's done three, though. He did another film called Hello, My Name is Doris, which was a more understated, smaller film alongside Sally Field and Max Greenfield. An excellent film if you get the opportunity to check it out. It's just hard to get in this country.
It's good, because we are going to be talking about, in the third section, we'll be talking about the some big actor-director collaborations. And before we get into the film itself, what do we think about their style, Kumail Nanjiani and Michael Showalter? What do they each bring to the table for the other to work with?
I think, for me, it's sort of like... because I'm a big fan of Silicon Valley, so I knew about Kumail Nanjiani's capabilities beforehand as a comedic actor. And the same with Michael Showalter. I've I've seen stuff like Wet Hot American Summer that he's written, and he also wrote They Came Together, which was it was like a rom-com parody with Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler. So it's sort of like the combining of those styles really worked. He sort of like made Nanjiani sort of like an A-list actor now, one that's capable of, he's shown a lot of trust in him to sort of like play lead roles now.
See, I've just become so used to like Kumail Nanjiani being like a guest comedic actor.
Yeah,
like he's
a supporting actor.
Everyone likes him and he's reasonably famous, and they bring him on for like cameos or supporting roles. But I never pictured him as like a rom-com lead.
Yeah, yeah. So it's sort of like if you watch his cameo in Mike and Dave Need Wedding Days, you think, how is this guy going to be a lead actor? That seems crazy. And like in Silicon Valley, he's not really like, he's one of the main cast members, but not many of the plots are surrounded by his character. He's sort of there as a comic foil alongside Guild Foil.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you just watched Silicon Valley from the start, like I've been a big fan of Silicon Valley as well, and you wouldn't have thought that he would be the one to be sort of successful in terms of like having leading roles. You'd have thought probably Thomas Middleditch or, you know, Martin Starr or somebody would, you know, be more.
I remember of thought he was.
Who's from Silicon Valley that, you know, crashed and burned?
TJ Miller?
Yeah.
He quit Silicon Valley because he thought he was going to be a big film star.
And then he ended up appearing as the Emoji Movie.
Emoji Movie, yeah, exactly. That was sort of like around the time that he quit. So it's sort of like.
I'm sure he got paid a reasonable amount at the time. he got his check. I think my thing is, Kumail Nanjiani was very good in The Big Sick because obviously it was very personal.
Yeah.
To him, I don't think he necessarily had to keep stepping in the rom-com direction, even though he's great in this film. It's not necessarily the career path he had to set himself on.
Because it's against type, you don't really have, well, let's be honest, like people like him don't normally become that kind of character because he's a stand-up first and foremost. You don't see like they usually go into like their own sitcoms or whatever, but because he had already been in a sitcom, sort of like he couldn't really transition to like a lead role in a sitcom or whatever, like Aziz Ansari has with Master of None. So it's sort of like it's very different to most romantic leads and stuff like that. I don't consider Lovebirds as particularly like a romantic film.
Yeah,
I think it's more of an action comedy anyway.
What is it about?
It's about okay. Do you want to explain, Joseph?
Give me a plot synopsis.
Yeah. I'll give a quick plot synopsis. So we've got these two characters played by Kumail Nanjiani and Issa Rae, and they're sort of like having a bad spell in a relationship where it opens with their first date and it's all like they're actually lovebirds, so to speak. and then we find them going to this family event, and then on the way there they break up. But just as they break up, they go and crash into a... with their car, a guy on a bike, and then end up that way their car gets hijacked by a guy that says he's a cop, and then he goes and runs over the goes and kills the guy on the bicycle, and they're now lead suspects. So they have to work out who the actual guy that says was the cop in order to clear their name.
So shenanigans ensue afterwards.
It's sort of like
spectacular. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of contrived, but it works for the most part. Like, the film takes you on the ride reasonably enough. Yeah. That's not really my issue with it. I do
you
feel...
You thought go with it.
Yeah, it's one of them. It's fun. Like, it's definitely above average. I said in the group chat, it's got its problems, but it's not a film that really needs to reinvent the wheel.
I think it's funny enough. I compare it to like if you like watching a comedian on like Live at the Apollo or something, and you like the comedian, and so you laugh along with them because it's something to do, and you don't want to sort of make it feel bad because you're rooting for them. But what they're doing isn't particularly funny or groundbreaking.
He does try a couple of plot twists and turns, but none of them are particularly shocking.
Yeah, because you say like, well, it's not going to be solved now because there's still like an hour left. There's lots of like convenient things that happen. Well, we've got to keep them alive for this long because they've got to make it to the end of the film. So, you know,
As a sort of a side note, that's an interesting thing about watching something premiere on a streaming service, that you're aware almost constantly of the time that's left.
Yes.
And if you're familiar enough with, like, we've talked about so many films, and we all have a fairly good understanding of it. Like, and I think a mainstream audience has enough understanding of act structures now. The film, it's really trying to surprise you, but you just sort of know how the structure has to go, and that works against it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they're kind of lucky that this isn't premiering, it's not having a theatrical release. I don't think this film would have made money. Like,
I agree.
Not with audiences. Like, it premiered as number one film streaming on Netflix, but, you know, so did Murder Mystery with Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler. That was the most watched film of last year on Netflix, apparently. So, you know,
was that part really of Adam Sandler's deal?
Yeah.
Because that looked better than the other stuff that he's done. I haven't watched it, so it could be awful for all I know. But it looked better.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, back to Lovebirds.
My main problem with Lovebirds is I think the writing is really bad.
I wouldn't say it's really bad, but go ahead, sorry.
I mean, I think it is, personally, just because I think it makes two people that are, I mean, I'm a big fan of Issa Rae's Law from Insecure and Awkward Black Girl, yeah. And I find her really funny, and it gives them sort of the most boring, uninspiring, lackluster lines to deliver, and I made a joke earlier before we started, if you told both of them to just improvise their way through this film, it would probably be better than what it is, because it's, plus the plot is not, it's not very believable.
That's a major
problem as well.
Sometimes it felt like it was trying really hard to be an action film, and I didn't believe the characters to really fit into like an action film universe.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I was just looking at the writers of the film. It's interesting that they have three stories by, and you have two different writers, and none of these films that they've previously done or TV shows they've previously done are actually known at all. No. So it just seems a bit odd, considering how good a screenwriter Michael Showalter is, that you'd let, especially as allowing of improvisation that he did a lot in The Big Sick. In Wet Hot American Summer, that sort of like that you're going in this direction. I don't know. It seems a bit like forcing a plot down. So, you can't change anything. You can't say what you want because it's got to go in this direction.
Yeah, it jumps around from scenario to scenario and location to location.
Yeah.
And it sort of feels like they're struggling to find a plot sometimes, even though it's really strict in how it's guiding them, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, Michael doesn't. I don't think he writes The Big Sick. I think that's just Kumail and his partner
Emily Gordon.
Yeah, but he directed it and encouraged improvisation on set.
Oh, did he? Okay.
What I was talking about, yeah.
Honestly, this film could have done with Kumail or Michael Showalter having their own like run over of the script.
Yeah, that's what. That's like if they wrote it, or at least if Kumail wrote it, with Issa, who is a writer. I mean. I mean, they literally have. It's almost like they assembled all the tools to make a good film.
Then they put off the most important part to two random people from the street.
Comedic actors, and we're going to get a decent director, but we're not going to get any good writers.
You get together the A team, then you have. I've never seen the A team, but you see. You see where the metaphor's going. Actually, I agree with you, Ben. Yeah, it's like you have all the ingredients.
And you mess it up. Yeah, no, I'm not a fan. I'm really not a fan of this. I think I'm just angry that it's. I think I'm angry because they're two actors that I like a lot, and it's a director that I've enjoyed two of his films as well. But this is just this. I mean, this is no way to follow up from Hello, My Name is Doris, or The Big Sick. Issa Rae has done she did a rom-com earlier this year called The Photograph with Lakeith Stanfield. I mean, that's better. I mean, that at least feels like it's doing something, and it's not being corny, and it's not, you know, it's not, at least it kind of knows what it's doing. With this film, it's, as we mentioned, like, it doesn't, I don't think it knows what it wants to be, whether it's a straight-out comedy, whether it kind of wants to be a rom-com or if it wants to be an action film. So it just, it, and it does, and it achieves none of that, essentially. So
it's a bit weird because I think it's similar to, like, you know, the Steve Carell, Tina Fey film, Date Night, where it's sort of like you buy on an audience that would see them in anything because they're like fans of The Office or fans of 30 Rock, but then bringing them into like a brand new genre, which they wouldn't normally do. But oh, we still make it comedic because it's got Steve Carell and Tina Fey. Why would you not make it comedic if you've got these actors in it?
Yeah.
But I then, mean, sort of like, why is that the audience for it? Who is this audience?
Some of the subplots that it goes through, such as.
You can spoil. Well, you don't not spoil it, but you can mention the subplots, like, generally.
So where they end up being an audience.
Yeah, I know the scene.
That was not a good sequence.
No, it all felt very stale and I don't want to spoil it, but they make a really stupid decision, which you would have obviously known not to do. You don't have to be an expert in that kind of environment to know.
It's sort of like they're forcing them to do a specific thing, though. Like if you're in an audience and trying to keep a low cover, you just wouldn't talk at all. You just try and fit in. And instead, you're forcing them to talk all the time so you can tell the audience what's going on at all points. Yeah, I can see. You know.
And then it has to have this perfect timing thing to resolve the scene. I won't go any further than that, but
yeah.
I was annoyed whenever they were making stupid decisions because they seem like smart characters. They're set up to be smart characters.
And not, I think there's a review that I read, which I think is very apt in the fact that because I think for Joe and I and you know we know these actors as, I mean, their comedy tends to be fairly intellect based. I mean, they're not like, you know, sort of dumb comedians. They're, you know, most of their jokes tend to be quite nuanced. So it's hard to believe them in these roles. And I think that's a big problem as well.
Because they're actors that speak personally because they're stand up. So they're sort of like, they're used to talking about themselves. And if you see something like Insecure and something like The Big Sick, they're very personal to those kind of those people that the characters that they're portraying are very similar to them in real life. So to force them into these kind of roles where it's sort of like there's weird sort of tension between the two, and then the tension sort of goes away so they can move on the plot. I don't know. For me, I think it's a case of I enjoyed it for what it was, but I have full awareness that it's not very good.
Is that your... We can move on to recommendations now, Joseph, if you want to expand that.
I'd recommend people giving it a chance because I think for what it is, it's fine. I mean, it's 87 minutes long. It's not a difficult watch at all, but I don't think it's to the degree of their previous work at all. But I think for what it is, if you go with it and you're sort of like, okay, I'm going to just, you know, enjoy this. I wasn't bored at any point. I liked watching it. So for that, if you have awareness that it's not going to be very good, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Ben.
I definitely don't recommend this film. I didn't even enjoy watching it. Like, I know Joe said that he enjoyed watching it, and that's, you know, that's fair. I personally didn't. It was, I mean, like I said earlier, I started it and then stopped and then had to finish it because we were reviewing it. I'd say don't. There's so many films that you could watch with 90 minutes, and this shouldn't be one of them, in my opinion. But
are you interested in a very good Ben? Thank you. Are you interested in watching it, Isaac?
Sorry, Jamie.
Are you interested in watching it, Isaac?
Sorry, I just wanted to ask Ben a question.
Go ahead.
Ben, is this your Venom? Like your least favorite film you've ever reviewed on the show?
Probably, because I mean it's hard for me. I don't like giving bad reviews for films because you know, especially when it's people that I like. I mean, I like.
Yeah, you know the intentions.
Exactly. So I think that's why I'm extra mad at it because I kind of wanted it to be better and hoped it would be better, but it's not. And now I'm just really angry. So
angry. You sound very angry. I think also the only things I think that were negative I've ever reviewed was hilariously Venom and Rushmore. So
I don't think we enjoy giving bad reviews.
No.
But no, this, I feel like it just to prevent people from from going through what I went through.
I would say similar to Joseph, if you're looking for something to watch on Netflix, like, it's fine, but I wouldn't think any less of people for like stopping it and never returning to it.
It's certainly not something I'd say go to the cinema and pay to watch this film. But if you've already got enough subscription, you might as well give it a chance.
And now we're going to talk about another Kumail Nanjiani and Michael Showalter film, The Big Sick from 2017. And quite frankly, I'm still riding the high of just watching this film because it is very, very good.
I saw it when it came out, and then we watched it yesterday.
Got nominated for a Best Original Screenplay, I believe.
Yep.
Very well deserving. You're saying it was snubbed at the Golden Globes, I believe, Joseph?
Yeah, it didn't really make any sense that because they have a specific comedy or musical category, and this is the kind of thing that they talk of. Like, they nominated Trainwreck a couple of years before, which is a very similar film in terms of its tone, for Best Comedy and in Best Actress for Amy Schumer. I don't know, it might have just been... I don't know what happened there. Holly Hunter did very well during the award season as well. I think many felt she was snubbed for supporting actress at the Oscars as well.
Speaking of which, she did a very good job in this film with Ray Romano, basically the main supporting
character. Ray
Romano's
had a bit of a renaissance.
Romano, for sure.
With this and Paddleton last year, he's sort
the Irishman as well, like the scenes he was in. He was like,
For sure. He's shown
more than... What's in that film he's going to be in? I really want to see. What's it called? Bad Education? Not that Bad Education.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the one with Hugh Jackman.
I really want to see that whenever it comes out.
Not that Bad Education, but the other one.
Yeah.
I feel like Zoe Kazan did a very good job as well. I feel like she has a bright future.
Yeah, it's a very difficult role to play, considering because she's playing a version of Emily V. Gordon, who was the screenwriter.
Before we get into it, guys, should we give a basic plot synopsis for our audiences?
Yeah, do you want to do that, Isaac?
Sure. I always write down a plot subscription. So yeah, Kumail Nanjiani plays like a fictionalized version of himself, and in the film he's like he has two jobs. He's like an Uber driver and he's also sort of a stand-up comedian on the side. And then during one of his stand-ups he meets sort of a person who's becoming or is a psychiatrist played by Zoe Kazan, who's playing Emily based on his own writing and romantic partner Emily Gordon. And you know, they fall in love, you know, they start a relationship, and sort of, you know, it goes on for a little while, but then sort of after they break up, it's sort of for a reason I won't spoil, she falls ill. She has to be put in a medically induced coma. And this is sort of in the first sort of third-ish of the film. It's not really a plot spoiler. It's in the trailer.
Yeah.
But sort of Kumail Nanjiani has to sort of, it's to sort of deal with that, but also sort of, I don't know, like the tension or somewhat of a friction between him and her parents.
Well, it's interesting.
Ray Romano and Holly Hunter.
Because...
It's sort of... Go on,
Jamie. I was just going to say that so earlier in the film, there's a big, I'll sort of spoil it, but there's a conflict between them about meeting each other's parents, and of course, the entire setup for that is, oh, okay, now they're going to meet. Now he gets to meet her parents once she is in a medically induced coma. And they are surprisingly well, there's tension, but they are actually surprisingly welcome to him. And it's got this really nice B story of like him bonding with them over time.
This is how the film works, right? Because it cares about its characters more than anything else.
Yeah.
So for a film like this, you've got to be on board with the characters. You've got to root for the relationship, and you've got, because there's several reasons why you wouldn't root for this relationship based on the evidence of what you see in the film.
Yeah.
The idea that it would break up Kumail's relationship with his own family, and so many other differences between the two. So what it does, it fits it in sort of like three sort of sections. You have Kumail interacting with his fellow comedians, you have him interacting with his family, and you have him interacting with Zoe Kazan, and you have him and with her parents as well. So the way that that works is that you see all sides of his personality, and he sort of changes the way that he is around each of these sort of circles. And I feel like if he was playing sort of like a structured character, then you wouldn't see those changes. But because he's playing a version of himself, it can allow us to see him sort of as a well-rounded character. So you sort of see his true intentions with everyone he meets. I think that's very important.
We don't really
for
get to
works.
See the other characters interact a lot, which I think is important for the early film, and then later on, the worlds start to like cross over quite a bit.
Yeah,
which is a good way of like demonstrating the growth of relationship between Kumail and everyone that's important to him in his life. Oh, I will say the comedians were great.
Oh yeah, so
Bo Burnham.
I love Bo Burnham. The best scene is when they're talking, where there's this guy, one of the comedians is terrible, there's this guy called, and he's pitching this joke, and he's sort of like, okay, so a dog's got a boner at a airport, is it the guns or is it the drugs? What do you think of that joke? I was like, okay, so instead of airport, how about you quit comedy and never start again? I just love it. It's just, they're so deadpan.
This is another movie in the past few years that makes stand-up comedy look like the worst form of comedy that anybody can do. Like, I don't think I've seen a comedy in a long time where they say, hey, stand-up comedy is actually pretty good. It's like, all of them make it look like it's the worst thing anyone could do.
There's quite a few good films on stand-up comedy recently. There was obviously Funny People, another Judd Apatow film. There was Obvious Trials.
I'm not saying they're bad movies. I'm just saying they make stand-up comedy look like
I'm saying it works cinematically, though, because obviously people are used to watching them. Like, especially with Netflix and stuff, you're used to watching them on sort of like the same way that you would.
Joseph, don't forget Joker. Film.
Joker is also to a extent. And
shout out to the guy
twice as well, but that's more improvisation rather than stand-up.
Shout out to the guy who actually plays Chris, who is Kurt Brownell. Because he is a stand-up comedian, and to play someone who is bad at stand-up comedy compared to everyone else, that's got to be quite a tough role.
They come to Daniel Day-Lewis if Daniel Day-Lewis was terrible.
What was weird in the film was, who's the actor, Joseph, who plays Kumail's brother?
Adil Akhtar.
Yeah, it was just so weird seeing him in a comedy, because he was in this TV film a few years ago called Murdered by My Father.
He won for
best actor, and he was so good in that, and like he was such a vile character. So like, the film goes on, and then like he's somewhat of a comic relief.
I feel like he's really important for two aspects. One, because he adds the British humor to it, which I think works really well. And two, he's actually Pakistani descent. I mean, the rest of Kumail's family is played by Indian actors. So to have another actor of Pakistani descent is very important for their dynamic. And you sort of like the scene with them playing baseball together and stuff. It really, really works. You see sort of like his reactions with his family of the probably one member of his family that isn't so like focused on traditions as the rest of it.
Oh, that scene when he goes to have dinner with them towards the end of the film. I won't go into it, but the dynamic between him and his brother is just fantastic. It's so believable.
And cars
as well.
In that. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I think that's the best movie with cars to describe how a character feels. I think it's better than Love Actually.
I was going to mention that, some of the discussions and some of the topics that it brings up, such as, you know, religion and culture, interracial coupling, and even illness, I think it does it in a really smart way, and it avoids sort of like the common tropes in terms of how you want to deal with those topics. It reminds me a lot of how Aziz Ansari sort of tries to do that in Master of None as well, where there's a comedic element, especially when they're around as a family, like Kumail Nanjiani and his character, Kumail. And when he's with his family, the way they sort of talk about it, the way it's portrayed is very, it's very smart. Like it's not done in a way that is a tall fake. I think that's really important. Another thing is every character sort of feels rounded out. So each character sort of serves a purpose, and there's, you know, they're not just like, you look at the mother who's played by Holly Hunter. I mean, she has her own, they each have their own story, which is kind of talked about a little bit, which is why this film is, you know, you'd think it's a bit too long for what it is, but that's because they really do allow for enough time for us to really get to know each
it doesn't level. Get boring though. I think it has a really good, even when it's like stationary at the hospital, it has a really good momentum to it.
That's what he's the best at, allowing his characters to breathe. You sort of like, you see them in all kinds of different situations, and you sort of like allows you time to understand sort of like what's going on.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And you can sympathize with all the characters' perspectives as well.
Yeah. The chemistry between Zoe and, I mean, even though we don't see it for for the first act in the film, and it's very strong. I mean, it's a lot better than he and Issa Rae and Lovebirds. I mean, here it's they're funny, but they're also sort of, you know, deeply charming, and like they're believable as a couple. Zoe Kazan, I'm a big fan of. I mean, she's written and done Ruby Sparks and What If, and I'm a big fan of hers. But yeah, in this film, I think she's really good.
Yeah, she's always really good. I think she's maybe my favorite character, even though she's not in the film as much. I think like her and Holly Hunter and Ray Romano are like the highlights of the film for me personally.
Indeed. She's one of my favorite actresses. I mean, she's in a show called Plot Against America. She's done Ballads of Drugs. I'm a big fan of hers. And in this film, she's really good. She's really good. And this film made money. Like, I mean, like, for what it is, it made, you know, quite a bit of money.
Budget $5 million, box office nearly $60 million.
Yeah. I mean, that's especially for an Amazon film, like for streaming.
It gets rid of all kind of perceptions on sort of like on certain you know, races not sort of like being bankable and stuff. Because people want to see representation on screen all the time. I think with this and The Farewell as well was another example of a film that did surprisingly well, even though they're not traditionally bankable.
It's kind of interesting to see how romantic comedies have been in the past, like the previous decade, because sort of at the beginning, it was still like, you know, you would still get like, it would still be a massive genre and people would still see them in droves in cinemas. But then the sort of genre sort of declined in popularity, and now sort of, not The Big Sick directly, or like was the main reason, but you're kind of seeing more of like, you know, the romantic comedies being more on streaming services like Netflix.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should be, you know, whether they're good or bad.
They were like TV films for a while.
Yeah.
I think that's similar. That's similar to even the television shows that are of that romantic comedy ilk. I mean, they're being, I think because they're being more personalized by the people creating them. They found a home in streaming services where they probably wouldn't in a big studio like a CBS or an ABC. And they've sort of found a fan base within that.
Speaking of that personal element, it must have been quite bizarre. So it's based off of his actual like early days, him and Emily Gordon, their actual meeting and the start of their relationship.
Are fictionalized. They're like the part where she discovers his the box where he's keeping picture. I mean, that was fictionalized.
Yeah.
And there's some part. I mean, apparently the portrayal of her parents, Emily's parents,
is all fake as well.
So yeah, I mean,
and the end of the film as well, towards the relationship between Kamala and Johnny and his mother is fictionalized as well.
Exactly. So I mean, it borrows a lot from their personal life, but it also sort of creates sort of stories of its own.
It's really becoming
the direction the Apatow films are going in anyway, with Trainwreck and with King of
Staten Island. That's what we're going to talk about. It's becoming its own genre of like real life reflections in these like comedies or romantic comedies. Yeah. Have you seen when's King of Staten Island out?
It's out like the 20th of June, something like that. I think it's released on the 12th in the US, but it doesn't come back here. Let's have a look. Was it Friday? Yeah, Friday 12th. I think it comes out, I want to say 26th of June in this country.
And that's actually directed by Judd Apatow, who produced this
film.
Yeah,
he produced this film. Yeah.
I was just going to mention, since we're talking about Judd Apatow, even with his television show, which I know Joe isn't a big fan of, but Love, which was a Netflix show.
I'd quit that.
Painful. Why I bring it up is that you can kind of see the direction of where they're going. It's like making really sort of humanist characters and try to. I mean, with the Love for me works because it's. I mean, I enjoy the characters, but it's very personal and it's very slow. So it kind of shows, you know, the ins and outs of every relationship. And for some people, that can be like, ugh, you know. But for some people, that could work. But certainly there's a way in which most of what he's producing or directing or writing is there's a direction where they're going where it's meant to be very true to life, and that's what this film is as well.
He like effortlessly subverts expectations as well. Like I was never quite sure of how the relationship between Camille and Emily's parents was going to go. I think it sort of kept the tension up there, which I actually really enjoyed. It it keeps you invested. And this is coming from someone who doesn't normally care about romantic comedies.
Well, it's difficult because I think you have to change sort of the style of the dialogue, because all the dialogue beforehand had been quite naturalistic.
Yeah.
They talk how people normally talk. But when you're sort of like given a situation where you're with someone else's parents, they know that you've broken up, that you're not together anymore, you know, you don't know them particularly well either, and you're thrown into this really terrible situation where everyone's feeling a lot of different emotions at the same time. To sort of like get that awkward tone matched alongside and not look out of place to the naturalistic tone of Kamal talking to his friends, or their stand-up or whoever, is very difficult. And I think that's a testament to how well the film is written.
Exactly. I was just going off of what Joe just said. I think that is definitely a testament to the writing, and that's why I wouldn't even call it like a. I feel like it's kind of defeating just calling it like a straight rom com, because I think sometimes it's more than that.
Sure.
So, and that's again just, you know, testament to the writing. It's very. I mean, it is, in my opinion, like more of a drama than it is a romantic comedy, and that's because it's. The characters all feel very nuanced and lived in, and that's just, you know, because the writing is excellent. I mean, it took them 3 years to develop a story that they experienced, so you can tell that they really put a lot of work into making the characters feel very you know, complex a bit.
I've seen people say that the one-man show scenes sometimes feel unnecessary. I appreciate the point of him is to like develop him opening up more over the course of the film. I do feel like the scene's going a little bit too long, but it's not like it's not boring either.
That's all the point, because it's supposed to be intended so you're aware that it's boring at the start.
Yeah.
And then when the time he develops it, it gets a lot better. So you see with the first stand up show, it's sort of like explaining everything to do with Pakistan, he goes into like cricket, so he's like this whole board of like cricket positions and stuff,
and it shows his respect for his culture as well, despite him not being very religious.
Sure, because I think it holds a lot of responsibility, because there's not many films, well, any really, in Hollywood that are made about Asian countries, Asian culture, especially not Pakistani culture at all. So I mean, like, the Indian market's a massive market, but in terms of the Pakistani market, it's not so much in this country, and I feel like it holds a lot of importance in understanding culture, Muslim culture as well. You know, it's got a lot of important representation dynamics to it.
And it does such a good job of exploring the different perspectives on tradition, which I really like seeing.
It's very similar to how sort of like it's portrayed in Master of None with parents and Indians on TV.
What's our? We'll give our recommendations, starting with Isaac.
Oh yeah, I would recommend this film. I'd recommend Big Sick. I think what I like about it is that even though the characters can be sometimes a little sort of exaggerated and over the top, like the film does feel very tonally consistent. It feels very grounded. Like even though this is based on true events, it's not just because it's based on true events that automatically makes it feel real. It does feel real because of the talents of the writing of Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon, and you know, and I think. Even if the subplots seem like they don't seem very connected, I do think they are, you know, connected and are important. And yeah, I think that's it. I think the ultimate goal of anything you could consider a romantic comedy, even if you don't sort of pigeonhole sort of the film as one, you gotta have the two leads be believable, and you want to see them go through, you know, you want to see them like, you know, go through with it. And without spoiling the ending, like I thought it was one. Very, very satisfying ending, especially the last scene, which is kind of Kazan and Nanjiani are just really, really great together, as well as you know, Holly Hunter and Ray Romano. So I recommend this film. It's on Prime, isn't it? Cause it's Amazon.
Absolutely, that's where I watched it.
So,
Living on Screen.
Oh yeah, I mean, I definitely recommend this. So much the antithesis of Michael Showalter's recent film, because it is a very clever film, and you know, every part of it feels like it's been worked on for like over a long time, and the dialogue itself is amazing, and I definitely recommend.
Fantastic. Joseph.
This film is like my cup of tea for sure, and this is the second time I've rewatched it yesterday, and it definitely holds up. I think there's a real timeless quality to it, and I think it's going to be a film that people are going to refer back to and watch for many, many years to come. It's a really terrific film. Definitely check it out if you get the opportunity.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's definitely the top of its genre. For our final section, we're going to be discussing some director and actor collaborations, and we're just going to be giving our thoughts on ones that we really appreciate. Does anyone have one they particularly want to shout out? Anything that comes to mind?
No.
We talked a bit about in the break. So Martin Scorsese has the ones that I usually talked about are DiCaprio and De Niro. With DiCaprio, he's done like Departed, Shutter Island, Wolf of Wall Street. With De Niro, he's done Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas. But Joseph, you said you wanted to shout out somewhere a bit different.
Joe Pesci.
Yeah.
Recently come back after a long time away with The Irishman last year, and Scorsese obviously started out with Raging Bull alongside De Niro and Goodfellas as well, which he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for. I feel like, sort of like, with DiCaprio and De Niro, as great as they've been in Scorsese films, they've also been capable of great performances with other actors.
Yeah.
Both have won Academy Awards for films that aren't directed by Scorsese. So DiCaprio with a Inarritu film and De Niro with a Francis Ford Coppola film. So,
what about Raging Bull, Joseph?
Yeah, I know. I was saying as well as Scorsese films. Well, with Pesci, all of his Oscar-nominated performances are on the direction of Martin Scorsese. He's absolutely unbelievable in all of those films. And Casino as well, I believe he was in. It's sort of like, I consider with this, sort of like, how good an actor is under a certain director compared to the rest of his career. So with Pesci, he's sort of like been forced into, because he's naturally funny as an actor, even in dramatic films, he's sort of like been pigeonholed into sort of like the comedic genre, but he's always shown more capability in a Scorsese film than anywhere else.
Absolutely.
So, and his contributions as a supporting actor in those films, he's a perfect foil to someone like De Niro, or a Pacino or someone like that.
Do you know what a good comparison is?
Yeah.
I just thought of. In terms of, like, in a more extreme example, in terms of someone who usually picks, like, worse films when they're not with a certain director or sometimes phones it in, I think Samuel Jackson and Tarantino is a really good comparison.
Sure.
Because normally, like, Samuel Jackson's appearing in a lot of B-movies, or he's appearing in like Avengers, where he's basically playing himself. It's a much easier role, but I think he only really challenges himself when he's in a Tarantino film.
For sure, because he's such sort of like a bankable actor, a straight A-list, he sort of like only really lowers himself to a spotting role for Tarantino.
Yeah, or Wes Anderson and Bill Murray.
I think Wes Anderson with Owen Wilson would be a better comparison, to be honest.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like that.
Because Bill Murray, again, is another actor that's great in like, everything and was a great actor before he worked with Wes Anderson, but sort of like Owen Wilson's peaks in his career have been very much, both writing and acting, have been with Wes Anderson.
Because he sort of like came up with Wes Anderson and then he went off on his own career of like comedy leads.
Yeah.
With some passes and some fails.
For sure, yeah. Inconsistencies. I think that's the case with a lot of actors.
Isaac, do you have a particular duo you want to shout out?
Yeah, we've talked about them quite a bit in recent weeks, but I just want to reiterate it. So Philip Seymour Hoffman, when he was acting with Paul Thomas Anderson, like, again, Hoffman was one of the great actors of his time, and, you know, cinema is a lesser place without him. And because I rewatched Almost Famous a couple of days ago because it's my favorite film and it was my birthday. And there's a treat myself for my favorite film. And there's the line in the film, so in the last scene in the film, because he is only a supporting character, he plays Lester Bangs. He says, the only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool. And I just, that line's always sort of hit me. And Philip Seymour just delivers that performance with such sort of, you know, what would you call it? Like just
gravitas,
yeah, even though it's kind of, you know, and it's sort of, you know, sort of what would you call it? Sort of a crying like face, a sort of a desperate thing. And in sort of his work with Anderson, whether it be in Boogie Nights, where he plays Scotty J. the Boomer Parade, who loves Marky Mark, or you know, Dirk Diggler, or Magnolia, or Punch Drunk Love, or well, my favorite performance by him from Anderson's career in The Master. Like, I think even if they're playing supporting characters, or if they're more like, you know, kind of what you consider more likable characters, like in Boogie Nights or Magnolia, or sort of less likable characters, like in Punch Drunk Love and The Master, like this, he still brings a lot of humor, a lot of depth, and a lot of love and care to these characters, even though they can be very flawed, like a lot of all the great Anderson characters. And I think even though Philip Seymour Hoffman won Best Actor for his performance as Truman Capote, I think like them together like brought the best out of each other, you know, like maybe as much as him and Daniel Anderson and Day-Lewis.
That's the only reason I dispute that slightly, because Philip Seymour Hoffman has so many other great performances.
No, it's not.
His performance in Capote is the best of his career by a mile.
Yeah.
Sort of like, it's one of the best cinematic performances of all time.
But I agree, but I
just... And Charlie Wilson's War and Doubt are other great performances. Of course, it's sort of like they work hand in hand. With each other with Anderson, because it's more supporting performances as well. Well, but because he's shown such great capabilities of directors, then I'd consider that lesser. But yeah, he's obviously such a great actor, and they work together, but you'd hope so, because he's such a great actor.
I wish we had more collaborations.
The idea that, like, even if it's a good actor, it can bring out the best in them, I think it's very interesting.
Ben Lewis, the same, I think. Paul Thomas Anderson definitely got the best out of him. But again, he's done so many other great performances.
Just something before I ask Ben is, I don't know if we get a chance to talk about, but one of the suggestions I saw was Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder, which I think is... The Mel Brooks films are probably the peak comedies of Gene Wilder's career. Despite him being such a... He's obviously great in any other film that he did at the time. I think that's a very interesting collaboration that I wouldn't have really thought about unless I'd been researching it and I'd seen it prompted.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of all three of the films that they've done together, producers Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. So it's interesting that there's ones that are going to fly under the radar, but... Because a lot of times there's going to be like directors and actors that really enjoy working together, but they're not going to have the Oscar winning films all the time. And I don't know if that's sometimes it can be. Is there any examples you can think of where it's a bad thing? You know what I mean?
I don't know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think. I mean, as long as both. Participants feel like they've made the best film that they can make together.
Yeah.
I think the most, and as long as they appreciate what they've made, that's the most important thing. I honestly don't think a lot of the filmmakers that we've mentioned, or the kind of filmmakers we're looking at anyways, care too much about Academy Awards or any sort of prizes or awards. I think they care more for who they're working with. I mean, and there are a number of reasons for why you work with someone over and over again. It doesn't have to be because you think that they're the best chance of you getting an award. It could just be you're very good friends, or you particularly enjoy being in the same artistic environment, or you feel like you're your best self when you're with that person. It's like, oh, you know what? If I have him in my film, my film is going to get a lot more.
And the takeaway is, if you haven't seen a Mel Brooks film, definitely watch.
I think an example of someone that's sort of like latched onto someone that's worse for their career is someone like Jim Carrey with the Farrelly brothers.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's
because he's one of the most capable actors of his generation, really, in terms of both comedy and drama. But doing stuff like Dumb and Dumber is great, but sort of like doing stuff like Me, Myself and Irene and Dumb and Dumber 2, it's sort of like he didn't need to do those when he's done stuff like Truman Show and Man on the Moon and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and I Love You, Philip Morris. Some really phenomenal dramatic performances that could have earned him an Oscar nomination, but because he sort of like had that connection to like Gross Like Humor or the Farrelly Brothers, sort of like has held him back over his career, and now sort of like his career's pretty much non-existent now, aside from Sonic the Hedgehog, of course.
It's like enforced typecasting, especially if the director you're working with doesn't switch up the genre a lot.
Yeah.
Who are you gonna? Did you have someone particular in mind, Ben, you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I was going to mention a few people. I was going to mention Setsuko Hara and Yasujiro Ozu. Yasujiro Ozu being one of my favorite filmmakers, and every film that he made that was sort of well received, always it was always with Setsuko Hara, and same for her as well. I mean, so much so that when he passed away, she stopped making films entirely. I think that's the definition of
what are some examples?
Tokyo Story, Late Spring, Early Summer. And I mean, they made six films together, and in at least four of those, she played sort of like the same. I mean, they're unrelated, but they share the same name, Noriko. They are similar in the sense that they typically single Japanese women who are trying to navigate societal norms and family in order to sort of achieve something greater or not. And it's a lot of the films. I mean, there is a whole trilogy of that sort of thing. And although they feel very, there's a part where you could, you might think that it's becoming monotonous. I mean, it's still, the films that they make together are still beautiful, and I mean, they're still well received. He's certainly one of my favorite filmmakers, and I think the partnership that he had with Setsuko Hara is one of the greatest in film, because you almost can't think of an Ozu film without thinking about Setsuko Hara in the same way. So that's definitely one mention. Anna Karina and Jean-Luc Godard as well. Yeah. I mean, she's passed on now, but she certainly, I mean, the peak of her career was, very much when she was, involved with Godard, in a lot of his films, and she was very much his muse in films like My Life to Live, Band of Outsiders, A Woman is a Woman, Alphaville. I mean, those films, when you look her up or when you sort of search for the name Anna Karina, it's always associated with Jean-Luc Godard, and even though she didn't
married as well.
Yeah, she did have a career after they broke up and stopped working together, but it never reached the same heights that it did when she was working with Godard. And that's another collaboration where it's like, you can't think of Anna Karina without thinking of My Life to Live or without thinking of a Band of Outsiders. And that's how great their relationship was. I also think the Coen brothers and Frances McDormand.
Yeah.
You think Fargo, you think Blood Simple, which is one of my favorite films. You think of Born After Reading. Those are some, I mean, I could also go on and, say Noah Baumbach and Adam Driver or something, but yeah,
Well, that's a good example of one that's probably got more gems to come. Adam Driver and Noah Baumbach. We'll call it there for today, guys, but it's always good when we get a chance to just casually recommend stuff, to be honest.
Mm.
I'm not sure what we're doing next week yet, but thank you all for listening, and thank you, of course, guys, for coming on the show.
No worries. Stay safe out there, everybody.